Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Mr. Yum Yum.
Mr. Yum Yum? Is there a Mrs. Yum Yum here?
Aren't I Mrs. Yum Yum?
Yes, of course. I see your Yum Yum ring. It's right there for the people listening. I know there are some who watch us. How do they watch us? I don't know. They crawl through the door and look. But for those who are listening out there, the Yumlings listening, Rachel wears a big ring. And on that ring, instead of a diamond, I can't afford a diamond, are you kidding me? It's actually a jewel in the shape of Commander Nandi. Just her, in general. It's in the shape of her. Rachel looks at it, kisses it every morning and says, yum yum, and that's how you start your day. How I start my day is Mr. Yum Yum. I started by pouring myself a nice big glass of orange juice with pulp, because that's what Sheridan would want.
Side of fortune cookies?
Oh, that's for kings, and I don't have enough context for those. And I drink that juice and I say, wow, we've got to do some rewatching of some sci-fi television, and that's how we kick off our day, Rachel. That's how we do it here at Yum Yum Pod.
That's how we alienate an audience.
Nope. That's how we invite them in, because people listening, you get Yum Yum energy when you walk in to this podcast. We're talking about revisiting, rewatching, and reviewing episodes of science fiction television. We do Star Trek Discovery, but at this moment, right here in this episode, we're doing Babylon 5. We're in the early days of season 3, so, and we're up to a very big one. If you've read the title, you know what one it is. So if you are worried about spoilers, you should be, because we're going to talk about it in general. So that has been your warning. Rachel, we named ourselves Yum Yum Pod because of Commander Nandi from Star Trek Discovery saying yum yum. Who would have said yum yum in this episode?
Well, we still have the Night Watch guy,
mm-hmm.
And he brings a lot of YYE.
Way more than the other episode he was in, yeah.
Like, he levels it up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is my last chance.
Yeah.
I gotta...
He's gotta do it. Is that your pick? It's a fair pick. I mean, I didn't have anyone else on my list. Maybe Via.
Mm.
Via had very minor YYE. But I'm giving it to Vaughn Armstrong's Night Watch member. He was a slimy piece of shit, but he was so gleeful in everything he was doing. He was exuding YYE, which stands for Yum Yum Energy, out the wazoo.
I do think some of the extras in the bar fight had a little sprinkling of YYE, but nothing to contend with Vaughn.
Well, how about we give it to General Smits? He would have...
Oh!
See, guys, he didn't actually say yum yum out loud, but if we decipher what he was saying and how he... and how he emphasized certain words, you can hear him say yum yum. He's the real hero of this podcast. I got Rachel. How far in are we to the podcast? I've already broken Rachel. It's not a record. I've broken her much quicker than this, but it's been a little while since I've absolutely derailed her. Welcome, everybody. We're here to talk about Point of No Return on Babylon 5, a very prestigious episode. The name of the season. It's on the DVD. Rachel, people can't hear me talking about Point of No Return while you're laughing. We're professional podcasters. People pay us to podcast on our Patreon. That's what funds us here. That and spite. And we're here as professionals. Rachel, this is no joke. Nobody comes to Yum Yum Podcast for jokes or for laughter. They're here for serious critiques on episodes of television. Now, are we ready to give our thoughts on Point of No Return?
I'm ready to read the description.
Well, let's get the ball rolling.
That's my job this episode.
Let's get the yum rolling.
Yum, yum.
The iron grip of martial law that holds Earth is extended to the station and enforced by Night Watch officers. But Sheridan remains defiant and comes up with a plan to oust Night Watch.
Ooh, baby, 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 it's point of no return. Big episode as stated. It's on the DVD cover. You know it's all series. It's episode 9 of the season, which, you know, usually episode 9 or 10 of the season are usually heavy hitters. I love this episode. Of course I do. I'm not crazy. I really do think that...
You love Babylon 5, and this episode Babylon 5 up the wazoo.
A lot of wazoos going up today, and I am a fan of it, of course, and I've said this before. The big, beloved episodes of Babylon 5 are big and beloved because they are that good. They are that captivating. If you are embroiled and attuned to the show, you of course are going to like episodes like The Coming of Shadows, Signs and Portents, Point of No Return. You are obviously going to like The Long Twilight Struggle and
the others.
On we go.
What are you missing?
Oh, sorry, TKO. And you're going to love those episodes because they...
Season 1 was so good, I got 2.
Yeah. I mean, Season 2 got 2. I also said The Coming of Shadows and The Long Twilight Struggle. Okay, Season 3, Exogenesis. There you go. Thank you. You got me, Rachel. I was holding back on saying Exogenesis was everybody's favorite, but I didn't need to say.
We said spoilers.
Spoilers.
We warned people.
Spoilers. Everybody loves Exogenesis, especially me. Point of No Return is a classic. And revisiting it, it feels like a classic where... Every big sci-fi show has their thing, whether it is TNG with The Best of Both Worlds, and whether it is Babylon 5 with Point of No Return and Severed Dreams, and we can go on, whether it's Star Trek Discovery with Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2 because of Yum Yum. And this, it is just the show tearing it down. This one and Severed Dreams is the show tearing down all of the structures that have been put in place, because the first 2 to 3 seasons have been meticulously putting all of the pieces together. So now we can start to break it apart and move it around. And now it is exciting. Now we can earn this instead of blowing our load in the first season doing this, because the uprising fascism of Earth has been there since the very beginning, but that slow boil and that slow elongated payoff to here was worth the build up. So that is...
It wouldn't work nearly as well without all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is your history and relationship with this?
I remember swatting at you when we watched this episode for the first time because I was like, you didn't fucking tell me this!
And then I grabbed the DVD and pointed at the cover.
No, you didn't, like, you didn't let me look at the back of the cover for season 3 because it had spoilers.
It's on the front, baby.
No, but I'm talking about the fact that you didn't let me know that, like, martial law and the seriousness of the situation. Mm-hmm. You kept that from me.
Why would I ruin it? I'm not a bastard. You asked me, is this going to happen? And I would just go, I don't know.
Yes, your classic line.
I don't know.
So I remember being very animated during the watching of this for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not sure how much shit was going to go down this episode. Like, a lot of the stuff that happens next episode, I thought that they would try and cram into this one, but no. They pace it out over these 3 episodes. Thus, we get this wonderful little trilogy in the middle or towards the middle of season three, with this being the second edition. And it's just so good. Like, everything in this episode is working together to create a masterpiece. And, like, it just all works. Even the minor imperfections.
No, yeah, minor imperfections. I'll give you this. Lou wasn't there. If Lou was there as the guy that refused to sign up to the Night Watch, this would be a 10 out of 10. That's why if you go to IMDb, this doesn't get a 10 out of 10 because there's no Lou. And that's a tragedy. The show did its best without Lou there, but its best wasn't good enough. Because if Lou was there, 10 out of 10 episode, but
I'm
now no Lou.
I'm sticking at a 9.5 because there's no Lou.
If McGrath was here, maybe more points, but no McGrath either.
No.
And Warren Keffer, if only he lived to see this. Tears rolling down my face, but I agree with you. This is an episode where the confidence and the experience is cemented beyond belief, because we have seen even in season three, there are little moments like with Exogenesis where there's just struggles to get episodes made to tell this story, pacing or characterization or even just plotting. And then you come here and it is very much, oh no, this is a master who is fully in the zone of their craft. And all of the acting is great. All of the, the direction and visuals are very good, but not too flashy, too extravagant.
But there are a few moments where I was like, oh, I wish that they had a little bit more budget for this moment.
Of course, of course. Like, they're saving it for the next episode.
That's the slight things that just nudge it down a little bit, because, like, it's also that hard thing of knowing that next episode is coming and many more that I think are just have no imperfections.
I will tell you what brings this down for me, and it usually does, even though I love the character. The Londo side of this episode, although very good, I do not give a shit about comparison to everything else that is happening.
It's very high stakes still, but in a very different way. So it gives contrast to the main plot, but it does really suffer because it's like, oh, we're going back to Londo.
What it is his plot is a building plot. It is building and building and building to wherever he will go in the future, while the other plots at play here are payoffs. They are the culmination of things that have been built. So whenever we do cut to Londo, it is a release of tension, and maybe it is wise to have that, but in a way, I don't want it. I want to keep being embroiled in the anxiety, the fear, the drive that is the Martial Law Night Watch, Zach Allen, Sheridan, and all of them, rather than cutting back to Londo, and this is a story that serves to just give us foreshadowing and prophecies and fates and letting us have little, oh my god, moments like Veer will be emperor too. Oh, I didn't expect that. And that stuff has its place. We enjoy that stuff in this show. And again, it's pretty well written in this, but whenever it cuts back to them, I am a little bit more disengaged because the other things are tremendous.
Yes, but I also get why they didn't make this a pure A-plot story. Like, I understand why JMS was like, we need the duality that's typical for this one. Because the next one is the way that it is. And it wouldn't work as well if this was pure revved up martial law energy too.
Yeah, I understand. I think the perfect example of what Londo's having here that works in another episode is the Technomage episode, where the Technomage episode, when it comes to him, is in the end paid off to be, it's building up and foreshadowing things for him. But the other plots in that episode were silly and fun, so you could have that take up the space. Here, it's good, and this is me as well. I am not a huge fan, even though Babylon 5 pays these things off and does a really great job of doing that. As soon as you get told, you have a fate, Londo, and you have three more chances to save yourself, and here they are, and you, the audience, now are going to be stroking your chin and debating and guessing what these mean, and they're so esoteric. That's the type of sci-fi fantasy stuff that I roll my eyes at traditionally, and even though Babylon 5 does a really good job with it, they pay it off, they give us things, and there's other examples in the series that I do like, here I still grit my teeth and go, okay.
I have a little story about that. I don't know if you remember this. Like, we'll get more into the Londo stuff, but this is more my history with it, which is why I want to bring it up now. When we watched this for the first time, I was like, I got really confused by the wording of the prophecy. And I was like, bitch, she said three more, but there's five chances, but
he's wasted two.
There's wasted two, but I was, for some reason, was convinced that there was only two more chances and that he'd gotten three, and you didn't want to go back and watch
the scene again.
And I was too scared to look at the wiki because I didn't get spoiled. I didn't want them to be like, and this means this.
Yeah.
So I made you look at the wiki for me, and you like just like zoomed in on the part where it's just like, he has five chances. Two are gone.
You have a chance few others will ever have, Mallari. You still have three opportunities to avoid the fire that waits for you at the end of your journey. You have already wasted two others. You must save the eye that does not see. You must not kill the one who is already dead. And at the last, you must surrender yourself to your greatest fear, knowing that it will destroy you. Now, if you have failed all the others, that is your final chance for redemption.
Londo's plot is fairly simple because it's so self-contained. He has pulled all of these favors, all of these strings to see the last emperor, one of the wives to Emperor Tahan, who was obviously the emperor that came to the station last season and died. So it's one of his four wives. It's his third wife.
What's his actual name?
Emperor Tahan. He didn't have a name in the previous season. He was just Emperor. They've given him a name now because they like the actor so much. But so that's a nice little piece of business because, him and the Prime Minister in the last season didn't have names.
Yeah.
In future episodes, they did get names after the actors that played them, because the cast and crew loved them all so much that it's kind of a little bit of an honor. But the Londo seeing this, the wife to the previous emperor, because she's a seer, she's a prophetess, and we get all of that magnificent little world-building stuff around that and reinforcing that some Centauri do have prophetic visions. And we also got told in season two about how the wives of the emperor work and how they communicate with each other because of their telepathic abilities. So a lot of cool stuff is happening. And Londo wants to see her, not because he wants to know if his future will work out in a way he wants it to, but the opposite. He wants to avoid things. He wants to make sure it doesn't go the way he sees, because what he sees is bad. And we know what he's seen. We've seen it all. The hand reaching from space and the shadow ships flying overhead and him as an old emperor dying by the hands of Jakar alone in the throne room. So he doesn't want to have that future. poor Londo. Too bad, buddy. That's just how it, that's how the cookie crumbles. And we get to meet Lady Mirella, who is the Emperor's wife. And it is, oh my God, it's Luxana Troi.
Nurse Chapel, please.
Please. Ship's computer. Major Barrett. There she is. Hey, it's her. This is probably the only thing I've ever seen her in that isn't Star Trek. That's, I'm saying it now. This is it. This is the only thing.
Isn't she in the original Westworld and you've seen that?
Yeah, not since my teens and I can't remember in it. I'm sure she's great in it. I just can't remember. It's been too long. And so Londo and her and Veer shuffle through the station because they do a nice job. And wouldn't you agree to this? Of although this is a fairly self-contained plot, they still weave it together with the events happening
still
on B5.
Happening in the world of the A plot.
Yeah, because we get a ground view of what's happening as a result of the Night Watch taking over and martial law happening, with Londo and Veer being point of view characters at the very beginning, of course, when they open up. What's going on? Don't you know?
Yeah.
Martial law. And then eventually when they go to the bar to see what all the hubbub is about, and then violence ensues. My big takeaway from this is not the three things that Londo has to do to save himself, which we will go over, of course. But to me, it has always been the reveal that Veer will be emperor, too. What was
that,
your...
That last scene with them on opposite ends of the window seat?
Yeah.
So good.
It's very funny.
I made your favourite. Spoo.
No, no, I'll order in. And just the idea of Londo ordering food in is very amusing just because he's so decadent. Although in season 5, we do find out that he goes to, was it Minbari's? So there you are, the Minbari fast food restaurant where they have golden arches of their own. What did you think? And what do you think about the revelation that Veer will be emperor too?
I remember being like, go Veer! Go Veer! Because at this stage, it's just like, oh, you're so young and innocent. You're going to make such a good emperor. You'll turn your people around and make them, you know, progress to the future. Instead of looking back.
Yeah.
Because that's a large part of Veer's ideology is like, yeah, we have this wonderful history. Let's make a wonderful future.
Yeah, I thought it was a neat revelation because you really don't expect that.
No.
That, you don't, I mean,
it
didn't
expect
it. It
throws you off because you're like, oh, yeah, she's very clearly going to see something about his future when, you know, she incidentally touches him with the cloth and she sees how he's going to die. So it's like, okay, that's very, okay, that's locked in. That part ain't changing. She's seen that too.
Yeah, he's going to be emperor. That's locked in. You can't avoid the being emperor thing. You're in it, baby.
But it's more about, I guess, the state of his soul than what happens to him. It's not about what happens to his body.
Yeah. And we know that when we do go over the three things, and there's even contention among fans and people what each of the three things are. Like, some of them people agree, some of them don't.
Yeah.
The IMDb trivia has some bewildering interpretations of them, which I find amusing beyond belief.
I didn't look at
JMS that. Has stated some of these, and they don't line up with what a lot of the fans' consensus is on them. So that's fascinating. So we have, you have to save the eye that does not see.
Which cannot be the Centauri eye because that has already been saved.
Well, JMS says that's what it is. In one of his audio commentaries, he's like, it's the eye.
But it doesn't make sense with the three opportunities still. Mm-hmm. It's like he's already done that, so.
Yeah, but he did save it. That's the thing. Like, he did, like, he got it in the end. Like, the eye was not lost.
Yeah.
Then the IMDb's interpretation of that is, it's not I as in eyeball, but I as in I myself.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, interesting read. My personal read of it for the longest time was
Jakar,
because he...
Jakar's eye that he loses.
Just Jakar being the representative of that, because he has an eye that does not see, because it's an artificial eye and all that. And he even has lines in season 4 about that, where, you know, how's the eye? It sees.
Yes.
And an empty eye sees through to an empty heart, Malari. Mm-hmm. And then we have not kill the man who's already dead, which is agreed to be Sheridan in the future. We see in the two-parter.
People argue that it's Morden.
I've never heard anyone actually argue that, and I don't know. I think it's just because Morden is a guy who's technically dead, as we saw in Shadow of Zahadum, but I think it's agreed that it is Sheridan.
Yeah.
Because Londo in the future will
save Sheridan
and Talen.
Spare Sheridan's life.
Yes, he will fight it through his keeper, using his final acts as emperor to help them free and give them the knowledge of what's going on Centauri Prime in the hopes that they can somehow save his people, knowing that he is going to die. Hence, it leads into your next one, which is sacrificing yourself, you know, giving yourself up to knowing that they will ultimately destroy you, which is the whole entire giving himself over to the Keeper, giving himself over to that, and then eventually fighting it and having Jakar kill him because... I don't matter anymore.
Yeah.
In my dying moments, in my final moments, I need to make sure that what I was apparently doing this all for, which is for my people, are actually surviving, are actually free.
Basically having a very similar revelation to what Jakar is having at the moment.
Mm-hmm. He's a lot slower to pick it up, Londo.
Oh boy!
Some may say tragically so.
And they say, Minbari have thick skulls.
Ooh, I wish Delenn was here to hear that, zinger. Wing, wing, wah!
Captain,
I'm all right. It's funny, I wish Delenn were here.
Jakar's gone through his spiritual awakening. Garibaldi lets him out, and because
she's like, everything's going to hell,
nothing matters, you should go free. And, Jakar can help them out, but he has to pull some strings. And who's waiting for him, Rachel, when he goes back to his quarters?
Talon!
Who? Talon?
Yeah.
Talon? The man with the sword?
Yeah.
He's back, baby.
He's been waiting for days and days and then sleeping for a day and then returning on the 6th because he's so committed.
Yes,
he had
to pay his debt back and he felt that it was the time to do it. And Talon, what a great character he is. I adore the Marshall Teague performance in this episode because he has to act opposite
when he's
Andreas
in that lift.
Oh,
when he's
in
that horny tube.
And he's just smiling to himself as he makes Lady Mirella uncomfortable.
Yes!
Oh, that was wonderful. That is a great example of you don't need dialogue there.
You don't
just
need dialogue.
Just silent and just the image of a Centauri noble.
The prosthetics.
Oh, yeah. And Marshall Teague has acted with prosthetics for the whole show, so he's, at this point, 3 years in, fairly comfortable with it, I would imagine, in terms of being able to express emotions.
But, you know, some people don't pick up that skill. Isn't that one of the reasons that we don't get Jakar's attaché, really, anymore?
Oh, the second Nathoth?
Yeah.
Mainly because they couldn't handle... Yeah, both Nathoths could not... Or all three of his attaché actresses could not handle the makeup.
Yeah.
It's very brutal.
Very, very brutal.
The
very
contact
difficult
lenses especially, too.
To work with and, like, to sit through the process, but also to act and have a long day on set with it. And I don't think I would fucking handle it either. But the way that Andreas and
Marshall
work with it.
They make it seem easy.
They make it feel and look effortless.
I really love the rapport between the two because Marshall Teague has a very difficult job, which is he has to react off of Andreas Katsoulis' amazing performance, where Andreas, as Jakar, is going through the whole rigmarole of the things he's learned, and he is absolutely beautiful in his portrayal of delivering this information.
So many great lines.
So many great physical gestures. Jakar putting his hand on his temples or his forehead to express the point. Like, and you just have Marshall Teague standing there. He is absorbing what he's saying. He's appreciating, but he's also like, that didn't answer my question, though. Like, cool, you're religious now, but what do you want?
Many a time I have considered getting a Babylon 5 tattoo. And one of the lines that I'm so tempted to get is the one that's like, not all replies are answers.
Oh, yeah. And we don't know exactly at this point what Jakar has cooking in his plan, but he is needing to rally up all the Narns on the station. They meet up at their usual spot, that one stairwell they live in. I don't know why all the Narn.
It's a set that doesn't get used much. So.
It's used for Narn shenanigans.
It really is.
They can't use one of the gray like ones because that's where the plague people die. Or that's where Inquisitors torture people. Or that's where a certain level's missing.
Yep.
And you can't have one of those. But what we can have, for the Narn, they're a noble people, a broken people at this moment, but a noble, strong, proud people. They meet up at a stairwell. Just one stairwell. Like, they're just there. All of them are there.
It's a metaphor.
Oh, that's it. It's a metaphor. Yeah. Like when Londo meets Morden in a hedge maze, like that's a metaphor. Mm-hmm. This is their metaphor. And he's.
Yeah, they can either descend or elevate.
Yes, he's rallying up all of the Narns for some purpose, and we don't know what it is at that moment.
They're shady with it. They're not giving us the information up front.
And we are
creating intrigue.
Oh, yeah.
The shot of the boots.
Oh, when Jakar goes to CNC.
Oh, my.
What is that performance from Andreas? I don't know what it is. It's very silly, very overarched, but I like it.
I fucking love it. I'm like, yeah, you go with that take. That take's it. That take is it.
It's overcooked as a performance in that scene, but it's memorable because it's overcooked. It's memorable because it's funny. That's just so the way good. He purses his lips after saying that he has a plan. Ooh.
And the fact that it's Vonova there on her own and she's just like, I can't tell you to fuck off. I want to tell you to fuck off.
Well, she respects Jakar too much.
But, like, I don't want to fucking deal with your bullshit right now.
Come on.
Shut the fuck up and leave me alone.
Why would she feel that way to a character I think she's barely ever talked to in the show? Have they ever
exactly.
talked?
Exactly.
They've talked.
Vonova
they must have.
Vonova has very little patience for people she doesn't know.
Yeah.
Unless she's dealing with them in a proper way for her job.
Well, you know how much she loves when people go into CNC and talk to her.
Then she does get fucking pissed at those people.
Anyone, including Talia, including journalists, including Jeffrey Combs that one time.
Oh.
Everyone comes to CNC to annoy Vonova, even Corwin. And he lives there. Well, Corwin, he lives in CNC. He doesn't have his own quarters. Have you ever seen him? Tell me, have you ever seen Corwin's quarters? No, you haven't. Because he lives in CNC. Don't you see that little pillow over there? That's where he sleeps. That's his room.
I have a problem with that logic.
Why? Why? Why?
Because that's the kind of logic that gets kids to think that teachers live at school, and I don't like I don't like it when they do it to me, so I don't like you doing it to Colwyn.
Look, look, look. Any of Rachel's students who listen to this podcast, I'm just going to lay it out flat for you, okay? Yes, Rachel lives at the school. Yes, I live there too. Yes, this is being recorded in your classroom that she teaches you in. Yes, that's cool. Are you allowed on the podcast? With your parents' permission, okay? That's what I'll say, okay? We'll give you a note. Your parents have to sign it. Maybe you can come on the podcast because we're an adult podcast. We say yum yum, which is very adult because, you know, has certain connotations to it. So the Narn in general, though, are serving to become the solution to a problem that will be formed by
the
taking Forlons care.
Have manipulated them into this.
Well, yes, yes. But they are going to solve a problem that will come about when Sheridan has to take care of the Night Watch, because the Night Watch are the bulk of security at this point, so you have to replace security with something, and at the end it's the Narn, and the Narn are in charge of security, and they're better at it than the humans. Well, they
make
in
up
security.
Like half.
Yeah. Because we still have good humans. They make a point of that throughout the episode. It's like,
there's plenty of people who say no.
Yeah, I really adored Vaughn Armstrong's line delivery of the whole group of people who don't want to participate, we're like, but we know who they are, and
we'll deal with them later.
We'll deal with them after this. We'll go get them. As the kids say, that didn't age well, that comment, because like 2 seconds later, they're dealing with him, in fact. Irony. And then their jobs were taken by the Narn because Sheridan is a smart boy. He put a truth inside of there. There was
an
actual
immigrants took their jobs.
Oh no, Rachel, don't say it. Don't say it, because if you say they took their jobs, I'm going to have to play the clip from South Park and that'll make everybody happy. Ah, fuck it, I'm doing it.
Oh, they took our jobs.
They took your jobs.
They took your jobs.
They took your jobs.
The Narn taking over security was not a thing that I expected to happen.
I did not anticipate that. I thought that they would help with the battle in the thing.
Yeah.
Against the Night Watch. Not that they would take the Night Watch's job. And they would stick around for quite some time. Quite some time we get non-security. And I fucking love it. I love that they just like put the badge.
Mm-hmm.
Onto their existing outfits.
They give them, and then they give the humans, they give them their own little outfits with the little badge sewn onto it, and it's cute. But it's a great way of making the Narn purposeful in the story, as well as showing that they as a people are not just wallowing victims of oppression.
No.
They are, in fact, of importance to others, and that is really great, because I've talked about this in, say, when we mentioned Deep Space Nine, for instance. Sometimes I get a little bit bothered by the Bajorans because they are so we're victims.
Oh,
and
no,
I do get tired of that.
Give
song
me my spelling I get my I spelling
do,
song
yes I do get tired of that song played so many times with them. And the Narn, I don't get tired with it as much, because they find interesting avenues to keep exploring with them, and this is just another one of those.
Yeah,
where we get to have
adjust
them
the melody every time with the Narn.
Yeah, and it's really cool.
So the Night Watch are evil.
Who told you that? Who told you that?
I figured it out on my own.
Rachel, that's sedition. You're talking right there. That's some seditious thoughts. I look. I didn't say anything bad about the Night Watch on the podcast, so you can't charge me with nothing. I'm not responsible for her, okay? I think the Night Watch are really sexy, in fact. I love those armbands. It's so stylish and very cool and neat and so nice.
Mm-hmm.
But you were saying the Night Watch are bad, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Clark makes a boo-boo.
A boo-boo?
He makes a boo-boo so Sheridan gets to pull a Sinclair maneuver.
You know, I remember so well when this all started to unfold that I just couldn't believe that they were doing it. I couldn't believe that they were actually doing it, and it will be even more unbelievable in a great way in Severed Dreams, but here when they start unraveling it all at the beginning where Clark has dissolved the Senate and you have
like,
these
Earth
Force...
Like, what the fuck are you doing?
Well, he's
taking
control.
You aren't as cool as Caesar. What the fuck do you think you're up to?
If only it was as cool and sexy as Caesar. But I remember being absolutely gobsmacked because... Yes, Earth has always been corrupted and evil, but it's the status quo.
This is different.
It's the status quo, and it's our heroes where they, you know, what they're a part of. So, oh, maybe they'll solve this relatively soon. Maybe this is the ending of this arc rather than the start of a new particular brand of it. And you have that scene with that Earth Force guy back home talking to them, and he has the television screens all behind him because it's there so that they can cut the television screens to the people coming outside to go shoot him. And he's just there to lay it all out. Hey, dissolve the Senate. He's grabbing power. All of these political figures are on the run. There's infighting in the military. Everything's gone, as General Haig said, everything's gone to hell, John. And this guy's just...
Shit's getting real.
He serves in this singular episode, that Earth Force guy, as a build-up to what we're so used to seeing, which is the figure on the TV back home that is ineffectual and cannot help them.
Yep.
Even though they may want to help them, they just don't have the means to do so. You have to do it on your own, Sheridan, because I'm literally getting shot at right here. The great escalation to one of the first actor's spotlights. Remember, one of our first actor spotlights was just that random senator on the TV who was like, hey, come here, I want to keep talking to you. Don't walk away, like when Sinclair walked out of the vision of the screen. And we are so used to in the show, every single time they cut back to Earth, it's either some corrupt figure, some asshole, some villain, or just some ineffectual person. And here...
Never somebody who's helpful.
Never somebody who can actually enact change and help.
No.
And this guy is very similar, but you feel bad for him because...
He's about to die.
He's about to, most likely, die, which is the greatest dramatic elevation that you could have of this thing that we've seen so many times before, in which this person can't help because the people, the structure that would usually be able to help is in fact taking him down, and it will most likely come for you next, Sheridan. Goodbye. And bone-chilling stuff, and a lot of people will obviously discuss this today with looking at it in the modern lens and the context that we have, but seeing these people raiding this building and whatever, it brings up a lot of images of certain things that have come to pass and, over recent times.
Oh, it's so clearly harping on McCarthyism in particular, that extreme power of senators and their ability to do things without any proof, without any provocation.
Yeah.
Because of the climate.
Yeah. And martial law is bestowed onto Babylon 5. Sheridan can't stomach it. He'll have to read it at some point, but it disgusts him. And it is worse because now the Night Watch are being bestowed the power to take over the security. And that's when we get our next one, which is the other seemingly corrupt or ineffectual help from back home. But this one has a surprising subversion of the standards that we have here. General Smits, the unsung hero of Babylon 5. If it wasn't for General Smits being all coy and shifty, we may not even have the events of the rest of the series.
He is pivotal.
He's a pivotal character in the whole show. He's excellent, and he's played by David Arquette's dad, Louis Arquette, who I was almost tempted to make our spotlight for this, because he's got a fascinating career, really excellent actor, funny guy, interesting presence, like he's a very interesting looking guy, funny voice.
He's a one and done, so we won't get another chance.
So I just want to say he does a magnificent job. So let's talk over his contribution here. So as we were saying, we are so used to the people on the TV screens being corrupt or ineffectual, and he comes across as just another mouthpiece figure.
Which is what the show wants you to think on that first viewing in particular of, oh, he's just a dude being annoying and not helpful. A lot of shows pull this same sort of trick of you see something for the first time, you don't realize the meaning of it, and there's a hidden message. And a lot of shows will edit the first one differently than when they rewatch it.
Yeah.
Not Babylon 5. It's the same recording. It's like the same exact takes.
Oh, yeah.
They don't change it round to make it more obvious the second time. His intonation and tone is the same the first time that it's shown and when they're having the conversation with him sort of live as when Sheridan goes back and he rewatches it.
And because they did it like that, you still feel a step or two behind where Sheridan is when he eventually, and then when Sheridan eventually reveals what he is doing, you go, oh, of course. Oh, wow, this guy was saying that. Oh, okay. Because I also want to say, I'm so used to focusing on his vocal delivery of those lines. I was looking at it today, his facial expressions, the subtle little things of him
leaning
being like
forward leaning a forward little bit on certain things.
The raising of the eyebrows of like, listen to the point I'm making here. The, you know, the chain
like
of
doing
command.
Doing as much as he can.
The political
without
office.
Raising attention.
Yeah, and this would not work as satisfyingly as it does if it wasn't for the fact the first three seasons has made this type of character the same note always. So when they finally play a different one,
so you're not expecting it.
When they finally play a different one, it's not only unexpected, but refreshing. You go, oh my God.
There are good people on Earth.
And it shows you that even in the midst of all the terror back home, there's still good people who are enacting rebellion or changing the course of Clark's reign from within.
Determined to commit that sedition.
And Sheridan didn't know that General Smits was a guy who's on the inside like them. Maybe General Smits has decided now this is the time.
Maybe he wasn't part of the Hague plot, but
yeah.
He's like, no, this can't stand.
And what he delivers to him is, well, the
political,
yes, the wording is going to help you here, because the Night Watch has taken over security. They're kicking people out who don't want to join the Night Watch. They are brutes. They are assholes, as we've discussed with Vaughn Armstrong's character. Oh my God, his performance in this episode when he tells Zach to bring some extra caps for his PPG just in case they need them, and he's like almost drooling at the notion.
Oh, he's frothing at the mouth for a fight.
Oh, he is just, oh, disgusting man. A disgusting
like,
man.
He is so eager in the way that he is waiting for violence to erupt.
One other thing. Make sure you bring some extra caps for your PPG. I hope we don't need them, but you never know.
Oh, what the hell is that supposed to mean?
Come to the meeting and find out.
We find out from the General Smith stuff, yeah, there's this whole loophole about the chain of command that's been overlooked in all of this mayhem.
The order for Night Watch to take over came from the political office, and the political office
is a civilian branch.
Not even a senator or anybody.
A governor can give the military direct orders.
Yeah. An order must come, order for the military must come
from the military.
Yes, it must be relayed through rather than just, yeah, the political officers telling you this is how it is. It needs to be done through the chain of command, which
I, as your commanding officer, need to give you an order.
And they snare the night watch into this area by using Zach to tell them that the Narn are going to replace them as the guards, and they buy it. And because in the end, it is a truth. But they lock them in there, and Sheridan gets to be all smug. Just be all, hey guys, it's me, Sheridan.
I don't know. It doesn't.
I read the book. You're breaking the law.
Not quite a shit-eating grin.
No, he's chuffed.
Yes.
He's chuffed with himself because he read the law.
Very
the book.
Different than when he rubs Bester's face in it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's a different shit-eating grin. That's like he's thrilled. This one, he is proud of himself. I think that's the difference. He's like, you guys are the bad guys. I'm actually being a good guy here. Yeah, what did you think of that whole thing when it came to how they fooled the Night Watch?
I was trying to remember if I believed that Zach was going along with it the first time. And I don't think I did. I always assumed that Zach was going to do the right thing. And even though, like, nothing in the show told me that that was certain, but just because, you know, they'd done the backstabbing second already.
And they didn't show you the meeting that they had with Zach. But also, Zach has been shown to be a guy
He's looking for a way in with the good guys. He wants Garibaldi's confidence back.
He's apprehensive at what's going on. He feels trapped. He's stuck. And he's a good person. And also, I would say, outside of talking about that kind of scripting stuff, like he's good person and they didn't show us the meeting and it would make sense narratively, in terms of messaging, it is Babylon 5 showing you that it can be hopeful and positive. Because if this was a truly cynical show, if this was a black-pilled show, it would be Zach Allen does not turn to the good side and actually turns to the bad side, and they trap him in there and ha ha ha, Zach Allen, you suck and you fell for fascism. And just because you were embroiled in fascism in any way means that you are forever a bad person and we are now punishing you, rather than showing us that people like Zach, people who can be entangled in something as insidious as this, something that is approved by the government and accepted as a truth around everyone, just because you've been entangled in that, another writing staff, another creator, another person could have easily just painted Zach as not a victim himself or anything, just as some moral lesson to say bad. But to have him turn and do the right thing, and even he's not sure if he's done the right thing because everybody keeps telling him it, but you know what, this time I do think I did the right thing here. It's a positive, it's a hopeful look at this, because Babylon 5 can be very bleak, as we've seen, and yet here, when it comes to character moments, it takes the optimistic route that somebody like Zach Allen can turn around and do the right thing, and because they did that, it's not as if him being a part of the Night Watch is washed off, but it is a step forward for him.
Hope manages.
Yes, faith and hope manages in these trying times, because we want the good guys to win, but you have to make it difficult for them to win. And with Zach, it was difficult for him to win. It was difficult for him to find his way out because he was conflicted, but also, how does someone like him escape this? And the set of circumstances in this episode allowed him to slide out that door, right out of there, throw off that armband and declare he did the right thing. And oh, I just have to get on my soapbox for a second, Rachel. When we did our thoughts on the Babylon 5 reboot, and if that reboot is ever happening, I don't know, the we talked about there's that weirdo crowd of people who are like, I don't want B5 to become woke agenda nonsense. I always think about this. When Zach Allen grabs his Nightwatch armband, rips it off, throws it on the ground after declaring he did the right thing by betraying the fascists that are taking over the government and the station. I wonder what those people see when they say, I don't want B5 to get political. I don't want B5 to be commenting on blah, blah, blah. I just don't know what they see when they see this. I just have a good giggle about that all the time because it's a prime example of what I like about B5. In that, yes, it can be very, how do we say it? Not just bleak or cynical, but very clear-eyed about how the world is. But again, it says, maybe we can do better. Maybe we should be like Zach Allen, in which, let's not be naive, people will most likely put their head in the sand and obey the corruption around them. But when push comes to shove, you need to actually take action. You can't be a bystander. And Zach isn't anymore. And it's excellent. I like that this moment with Sheridan, locking them in there and reading the rules at them and proving that at the end of the day, we can save everything around us by keeping the status quo and actually reading it and actually enforcing it. It's great, but what do you think about this in relation to the next episode? Because the next episode, he can't do that. There is no more, oh, I read the rules and I outplayed you. It is, we literally have to fight now.
Yeah, it's... You hold out hope for him because he really doesn't want to do it. But he says basically in this episode, I know it's coming. Like, an Ivanova, ever the realist.
Mm-hmm. It's a temporary measure.
It's a temporary measure. Clark will just reorder the thing himself. And then it is within the chain of command. It'll go down from him through the Joint Chiefs and eventually...
whichever remain.
It'll be up to you. And it'll be the right thing to do according to the chain of command.
Mm.
But also thinking back to the conversation that Ivanova had with Corwin of, is following the chain of command always the right thing?
Yeah, I thought about that too during this, especially when we did get the reaction that is very emotional from Corwin about what did we do wrong?
How did this happen?
What did we do wrong? And you feel for people like him because not everybody in this universe understands why this is happening.
No.
Just like how it is in our everyday life. There are some of these things where if you're not paying attention to every single facet of certain political things going on around you or societal structures and problems and issues, and then everything comes to this boil, you go, what did we do wrong? How did this happen? And man, what a great episode of television this is. But yeah, I was thinking about that a lot because these three, like the season three, the beginning of it is very much waving goodbye to some of the things that we are so used to.
Yeah.
Like your Julie Masanti type villains that would come onto the station. This is waving goodbye here to the, well, I read the rules and there's this loophole that you didn't expect and I've interpreted this so that it can work out for me in this way. Not saying that we won't see any of that again, but the prevalence of it and that being the thing that always saves the day is going to really dissolve after this, because after this, it is, we can no longer do that. We actually need to do what it says in the opening credits. This is no longer our last best hope for peace. You know, it's for victory.
Mm-hmm. But I really like the point that you were just making about what this episode is about, because that really does apply to both plots.
Mm.
Like, the point of no return is not just the stuff with Earth.
It's also the stuff with Londo because he's almost at the point where he cannot return and receive redemption.
Yes, and he wants to make sure he's not at the point of no return.
Yeah, but it's like it's a last chance that Sheridan will get to weasel his way out of it. And Londo's chances are running out as well.
There's a lot of brewing conflict and a lot of it going to direct fighting where we had that sequence at the bar with the Night Watcher breaking up a riot, but they incited it themselves, and the TV screen getting the chair thrown at it while Sheridan declares martial law, and Earth violence.
Baby Veer getting hit with a bottle.
Yeah, and I...
Oh, baby Veer.
I just like this whole story line in B5 where we have the problems with Earth, and it's been bubbling and bubbling since the very first episode, and now we're actually seeing the what it's all culminating to. Earth fighting with itself. How do you feel about that? Both when you first
saw
it.
The Earth Civil War.
Yeah, the Earth Civil War or the Earth, yeah, or B5 having to break away, because here we end the episode with them knowing that this isn't the end. We will have to deal with this. Now, to spoil next episode, I really didn't expect it to be literally the next episode that we will have to deal with Earth and make the big changes.
I didn't either, but the episode does set it up. Like, these three have a distinct pattern of, like, one main thread that's left that's going to be dealt with in the next episode. So in the first one, they're like, Night Watch is still a thing. We got to keep an eye out for Night Watch.
And martial law.
And martial law. And martial law is declared at the start of this, and Sheridan has to pass that on. And they have to deal with trying to shut down the Night Watch. And they also note that, like, you know, we didn't get everybody.
Yeah, and at the end of this, it is that is a temporary measure, like you said.
Yeah.
They're going to do it properly and bring it in to us.
Follow through on this. We're not going to get away with this.
And Haig.
And we're going to have to confront it. And Haig is probably on his way here. So all of those things are stated fairly imminently. But I still wasn't ready for it.
We aren't always used to these science fiction shows with a very well-established structure wanting to actually break it apart. You can have deconstructionist, ooh, isn't it wonderful, look at us, we're being a deconstruction of Star Trek, oh, look at me, I'm Star Trek Discovery, where, but at the end of Star Trek Discovery, it's still Star Trek. That you know in terms of that Starfleet and that person's a captain and they drive a spaceship and nothing really has changed. Even though Discovery's 1,000 years in the future, it's still the fucking same as it was in season 1 and 2. Nothing changes. Even though you're told things are changing and told that things are different because, oh, now they wear different uniforms. But here, you're being told that, and you're not only being told it, you're being shown it. And you will be continued to be shown it as we go along because really...
You're brought along that journey in Babylon 5.
Because you can't help but... You have to, as a show, reckon with your main characters are humans. But the other humans that are the government are evil and doing horrendous things. So our human characters have to fight against that. And if they are going to do that, logically, it would bring A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and on we go. And that's the rest of the series, what it will bring along with it. And I think for a lot of people, it is just a shock that it would actually bother to do that because... It
had a good thing going, so why mess with it?
And shows in a large way don't actually want to deal with problems.
No, because if you deal with problems, you have to resolve them or escalate them, and that means having a plan in mind or an endpoint.
Yeah, or you're like other shows where you're just wheel spinning or you just wrap it up super quick in a way that isn't, you know, satisfying from an audience's point of view as well as a storytelling one. But you look at this and you think, wow, they're just bringing problems upon themselves as a writer. And this is one of 14 million plot lines we've got going in the show. How can they do this? And we will see how they will proceed to in the very next episode. But yeah, it is just that excellent. Point of no return. There's a lot of great little scenes and sequences and moments. Sheridan having to stay up all night because he's just too wired.
Just sitting there in the dark when his alarm goes off.
He can't just sit there and go to sleep and listen to the rain hit the roof. That's over now. The nice times are over for the moment. It is having to take down your own people, as it is very hard because they're people that they know as well. Like Garibaldi knows his team. He knows each one of them. And now that they've gone this direction, it is absolutely heartbreaking. This isn't the same as fighting an alien that you don't know. Like, they don't know the Minbari and they characterize them as monsters. Here it is a war of, well, like we hear with every type of civil war. It is a war where you are fighting people that are your friends, people who went to your wedding, people you have had dinner with, people that you have just known or seen around the place, and now you're pointing a gun at them.
I thought us was what we've got right here. Now us is suddenly anybody who says the right things or wears a rag around their arm. And everybody else is the bad guy, right? Says who? A bunch of clowns back home who don't give a damn about anything but their own political agendas? Come on, you don't work for Night Watch. You work for the captain. You work for the station and you work for me. And I'm asking you, all of you, to drop this. Come on, rip these things off your arms and stop tearing each other apart.
It is the end of an era in Babylon 5. But it's not an end of an era for our spotlight section.
Our what section? Spotlight?
Get fucked.
Where we turn on a spotlight and shine it upon somebody? But what's the spotlight for, Rachel? And why am I having to get fucked? Why did you say that? Is it, I mean, I'm not a priest. Like in the film Spotlight, where they get fucked. Or they fuck, you know, little boys, apparently. I mean, I've watched the film Spotlight. We all have. We all love that film Spotlight. But we're not watching Spotlight today. We're shining a spotlight on a person that appeared in the episode. Isn't that what we do?
Yes, we are discussing Majel Barrett.
Why did you say it with such a fun accent?
I knew that I was going to mispronounce it, so I just made it worse.
We look at an actor or actress that appeared in an episode of Babylon 5, whether they're a one-time wonder, a main, a recurring, whatever it may be. We look at their performance, we talk about what we thought about them here, and any interesting background information and or what else we've seen them in, because it isn't just our main people that make up the show. It isn't just the JMS writing. It isn't just Bruce Boxleitner's amazing hairline. It is a lot of these one-time wonders or these really small players that help build up the world of Babylon 5. And these actors are responsible for that in large ways. And yes, we're looking at Majel Barrett, who was, as everybody knows, the wife of Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek. And she was, of course, in Star Trek a lot. And we are going to talk about her performance first, because she's not in too much of the episode. And I like it well enough. I think it's hard to wrap around it, because I am so used to her being Luxana Troi, where she's very loud and over the top and funny.
Yeah, it's very different here.
She's very much dialed back. She's very internalized in her performance. She doesn't need to be funny. She doesn't need to have a lot of lines. She's very stoic and solid, and she doesn't even need to move that much. And she's very regal in a different way to how I've seen her be regal in other performances. So it takes me a little while to recalibrate how I feel about her acting here, because I am clouded by my preferences to her acting in other material. So to judge it on its own values here in Babylon 5, it actually takes a lot of effort, because she is star power. And unlike Walter Koenig, where I can see him just as Bester because he's so excellent, here it is, her part is so much smaller, and it's only in this singular episode. I can't get that instant, like, flipping of the switch where I go, this is an excellent performance that's so different from what I'm used to that it's wonderful to see. A part of me likes it, and a part of me just finds it a little bit dull, and that if it wasn't Major Barrett, would I care?
It would be very thankless.
Would
it is already with her in the role.
What I mean is, when I say if it wasn't Major Barrett, like, if it wasn't, like, if she wasn't who she is, like, if I didn't know who she was in terms of, like, her real life and her other roles I know her for, if I just knew her for this, would I even consider doing a spotlight on her?
No, we would have done that actor, the military dude.
Yeah, I don't...
For sure.
Like, and I don't mean to speak ill. I think she does a magnificent job. She has some really great line deliveries. But to me, she just doesn't have as much oomph as I would like.
Yeah. But I'm also like, I don't want more of her in the episode because I don't want to take away from the Earth stuff. Mm. So it's hard.
So do you have that issue at all? Because you are also familiar with her work.
Yeah. I get hung up on the voice. Mm. I'm like, that's Luxana Troy.
Really?
She's not talking to Londo saying lighten up. Mm. So I'm like, what is this?
She's not naked and running around having sexy adventures or trying
No mud baths are hard.
No, but mud baths are hard. She's not trying to marry anyone in this.
No. Or stop anybody from committing ritual suicide.
Sheridan's not hiding in his quarters because she's on the ship.
So that's like a little bit, but it's also like there's nothing much to this, so I don't feel too bad that I get hung up on it.
Well, from my understanding, and you've done more of the legwork here when it came to her background as a performer and as a person, but also when it comes to this episode, but we're looking at it in terms of the contents within the episode, of her performance and her line deliveries and her character. But from what I can gather and what I've always known is that is almost irrelevant. It is the meta thing happening here, which is JMS had met her at some sort of convention. Am I following this right? You read into some of this where basically her role is not to serve as actually, you're really good for this part as an actor, and I got you here. It is a white flag, a peace treaty between Babylon 5 and Star Trek. That's what it's supposed to serve as, because there was lots of hostilities.
There was a press release stating that. JMS posted on a Star Trek forum. It was very much like, you don't have to be one or the other.
Mm.
You can like both.
Yes, and look, we've
got... The world is wide enough.
We've got Mrs. Star Trek on our show. Why do we need to be so so much in tribes about this? Why do we need to be you? I'm Team DS9. No, I'm Team Babylon 5. Fuck you, no, fuck you.
Yeah, at this stage, they're doing very different things, really.
Because that's what her role is more important for. It is the pull of getting her, not just because it's a sci-fi royalty, but what comes along with that in terms of, in the real world, both JMS and Major Barrett were kind of annoyed at the fans or the groups having these wars over these similar-ish shows. and it had to stop in some way. So her coming on here serves as some sort of peace offering.
It's
and
an olive branch.
It's an olive branch. And so
for
that,
those in the know.
So that's more important than what we actually think of her performance. But lots of people who watch the show may not even know that or care. So I do want to know from people who have no familiarity with this actress, do you like her performance here? Does any of this matter to you? Or what? Because to me, that is also a shadow that hangs over this. Is, oh, this character is being played by a person who's serving a different function than just acting.
Yeah. It goes next level when it's like they have the added we shit.
Oh, yeah, where she's speaking on behalf of her previous husband who was a leader
she's
and a creator.
Taking
and
on his spirit.
Mm-hmm, and people look at her with that when it came to Jean, because Jean passed away and yet she was still in the world and in Star Trek. So there was lots of looking towards her as this figure who spoke on behalf of what Jean would have wanted. And yet she was just a person. She wasn't Jean. She couldn't really speak on behalf of him. Like, she knew certain things, but like it was
also people weren't fucking listening to Jean at that stage. So.
Yeah, it's a whole tangled web of things. Have you seen her in much else?
No.
It's just Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
And this.
Yeah.
Because that's most of what her career was. Like, I did look through her IMDb, and she's in the Lucy show in an episode. She was in the Westworld. She was in the original Westworld.
She's in other things, but she's in so much of Star Trek, and we've watched Star Trek.
Mm.
So that's what we know her for.
Are you a Chapel fan or Lashana Troi fan?
I find myself saying that I'm more of a Chapel fan because you are so into Troi.
She's the better Troi.
She's, yeah, not talking about Troi Jr.
It would have been a power move if she was one of the main cast members.
For
TNG. If Lashana Troi was one of the main...
You maintain, and I agree, she is the better counselor.
Her and fucking Guinan are better counselors than Deanna Troi is. Anyone's a better counselor than Deanna Troi. I think Worf could do a better job, honestly. And he's a fuck up. He's a war orphan. That's why his name's Worf. I'm kidding, it's not. But imagine if it was. Yes, she's an interesting figure overall. Like, I looked up some of her stuff, but again, she was in a lot of shows before my time that I just am not familiar with. And even after the original series Star Trek, she was in some movies and things that I have no clue of. Like I know Westworld, I've seen Westworld, but then there are just some in there that I'm like, I don't know. And they're far and few between because, again, yeah, she had all the Star Trek work to do, like on the animated series or being on TNG as Lashana Troi and doing the computer voice and on and on it goes.
Yeah, she's like 5 years after her death, she was still getting credits for voices of computers because I'm pretty sure she died in 2008. And I think there was
was it
2013 credit.
Oh, right. Yeah. I'd forgotten when she passed away, but she died relatively young, like in her early 70s, I want to say.
I think it was 73. Because Jean was older than her.
I read that in the main ensemble of the original series, she was the one who died the youngest, I do believe, because everyone else was older when they passed away. So,
short battle with leukemia.
Mm. Mm.
She died at her home, and she was. I remember this being a really big thing on the internet at the time because she left a trust for her dogs.
Her dogs.
And her dogs had the right to continue to live in her house.
Awesome.
And one of her employees
got a trust so that she could live there with the dogs.
That's cool.
And then her son got a different property.
Okay. Wait, it's a dog's place. Let them have it. Anything else you want to talk about when it came to Major Barrett? Anything you found on your travels? Anything you found in your looking up of her?
I just found it really fascinating that they made a whole press release about her appearance in this episode.
It's a big move, isn't it?
Yeah.
I find her an elusive figure because when I read up about her, obviously our age demographic and where we are in the world, we weren't fortunate enough to meet her at conventions and wherever else to see what she was like in person and anything like that, then maybe some other Star Trek podcast can talk about. But whenever I read about her, it's more about like her in relation to Jean. Her in relation to Star Trek
as well.
Her in relation to playing Nurse Chapel or playing Number One or playing Luxana Troi, rather than like what else there was about her or like her pursuit of wanting to be an actress and then how it turned out in the end. Because in the end, it really was she did Star Trek and that really altered wherever she was going to go. And I would love to know more about her, but it seems like just digging up things, it's still a lot of, it's in reference to Jean.
Yeah. Her wagon is hitched to him.
Like, I've never seen that many interviews, if any, about, like, how she felt about playing Luxana Troi.
No, which is disappointing, and it's, like,
that just be me missing out on things, but really, I haven't seen that many.
I haven't looked into it, but to me it's like, yeah, that makes sense because the majority of media would be like, oh, that's Jean's wife. We don't need to talk to her. We have Jean.
Her voice is so iconic that it's the computer in this, and it's also the voice on some public transit systems I read as well in some certain areas for a certain time, and that's cool. That's really cool. I've always wondered what it's like for those people who do the recordings for, you know, when you're waiting for a train and it tells you how long it is or what station it is. And then you might hear that. What would it be like to hear that person in real life next to you?
Yeah, like the voice of Siri.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that woman has had a terrible time of it.
I imagine, yeah. So
I think she's had some good moments, but I remember the bad stories.
What about Cortana? She was a video game actress. She still is, but that's a story for another time.
That must be the Master Chief.
Yes.
His military record is outstanding, above the rest in strength, stamina, and good instincts. A natural leader, I see why you chose him.
What do we rate this? On our impervious scale, our scale of yum being bad and yum yum being good, what do you rate Point of No Return?
I do have some things that hold me back, Ryan.
Didn't have Lou in it. Didn't have McGrath. Warren's dead.
But and some of the direction is just a little bit bland. So, unfortunately, it's a yum-yum.
Yum-yum.
Like, it just skates on by. Like, it's more good than bad.
Oh, okay.
So I can't just give it a yum, and I'm not allowed to give half yums. Like, I said it was a 9.5, but... You know, and that's in yum-yum territory.
I just want to say, Rachel's joking, of course. She loved this episode, nerds. Don't write in comments being like, I can't believe Rachel's saying it just skates by into a yum-yum. It's one of the greatest episodes of all time. Guys, she's just joshing around, okay? I mean, we do that on the occasion, but don't laugh. Don't laugh. This isn't a funny show. We don't try to do anything.
Here.
There's no... Yum Yum is serious, people, and that's why I am giving this one a Yum Yum.
Yum Yum.
Point of No Return is an episode that just slaps. It just grabs you by the neck, lifts you up in the air, and slaps you in the face with its quality. And it is beautiful quality. Now, what are we going to be following up Point of No Return with? What are we watching next time?
Well, we're discussing the next episode of Babylon 5.
On an all-new Babylon 5.
we have the pleasure of watching Severed Dreams. As Earth Force, the destroyers hurtle towards the jump gates, providing the entrance to the station sector. The options are clear for Sheridan and his crew. Surrender or fight. They choose to fight.
That is from the DVD descriptions, people. That's how you write it. That has me wanting to end the podcast right now and watch that episode and then record our discussion on it straight away. So we better get out of here, Rachel. We better just better...
Skedaddle,
that's it. I was running out of wazoos to figure out the word I was needing to use there. We are going to go now, but you can find us on your social media platform of choice under Yum Yum Podcast. And we post on there regularly. You can interact with us. You can contact us more directly over at
yumyumpod@gmail.com.
We include all of this in the description of the episode. And if you have not rated and reviewed us on your podcast hosting site of choice, whatever one allows you to do so, we would love it if you did. It means a lot to us. So it just takes 2 seconds. All you have to do is just click the stars and give it the highest amount. I have phoned up Spotify. I have phoned up Apple, Podchaser. I can't phone them. They don't have a phone. I emailed them and told them, could you please make it yum or yum yum in your rating systems? And they didn't reply to me. I can't believe they didn't reply to me. Jesus Christ, reply to me with yum or yum yum. But nope, that is, they're too busy. But we've actually been pretty busy too on our Patreon. We're doing a lot of stuff on there right now. We're going through the X-Men movies. We're nearing the end of the X-Men franchise. We are about to watch the New Mutants movie, which will make us the only people in the world who's ever watched it, which is quite
No. One of the four, we are going to be the only people that critically discuss it in podcast form.
Yes, yes. Sorry. So some of the cast watch that movie too. And we have been watching episodes and talking about episodes of the series Space Above and Beyond.
And Ryan, that one's different because you've watched it and I haven't.
Yes, so people, if you have not seen Space Above and Beyond before, but you've been meaning to check it out and you want a companion for your journey, or if you're someone like me who's seen the show before and you like listening to podcasts of people going through a thing for the first time, come on over to our Patreon. We're doing Yum Yum and Beyond. We're a few episodes deep into Space Above and Beyond, so come on over and join in on the fun. You'd be a part of the group Discord as well when you join our Patreon. But enough rambling from me. Jakar was here. He was too spiritual, too enlightened, and a little bit too busy in a stairwell to say good eating to you. But I'll say it to you, Rachel, because I'm not in a stairwell.
Good eating to you, Ryan.
Oh. Good eating to you, Rachel.